Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA, designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries. Beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space MBA.
Artemis II readies for flight, and a closer look at tardigrades, a microscopic marvel. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Artemis II is one step closer to launching. The Space Launch System rocket and the Orion spacecraft are now on the launch pad, awaiting takeoff, which could happen as early as next month. We'll speak with Seminole State College's Derek Demeter, who photographed the rollout of the SLS rocket for us here at Central Florida Public Media. Plus, we will also take a look at the motivations behind this mission with Florida Tech's Don Platt. Then, did you know we have sent bears into space? Not the big grizzly bears, but tiny microscopic animals nicknamed water bears. We'll speak with Are We There Yet's Orion Boone about why scientists are studying these microscopic organisms to help us humans better explore deep space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? On Saturday, NASA rolled out its Space Launch System rocket, or SLS, with the Orion spacecraft to its launch pad at Kennedy Space Center, making it one step closer to launching astronauts on a mission around the moon and back. With hundreds of people watching the massive vehicle crawl towards the launch pad, Derek Demeter says it was awe-inspiring. He's the director of the Emil Bueller Planetarium at Seminole State College, and he's photographing this mission for us here at Central Florida Public Media. Derek, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Awesome to be back. Yes, it's been a while, I think.
It has been a while, but you have come bearing gifts, some incredible images of the Artemis II rollout. Derek, tell me a bit about what it's like to see this vehicle up close as it was rolling out of the VAB.
One of those things that you could probably see it 8,000 times, and each time you're just in awe like the first time you see.
Support for WMFE comes from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's worldwide campus, where highly ranked online degree programs offer the flexibility to learn what students want from wherever they are. More at erau.edu/worldwide.
Seen it. You have this huge machine that's being carried out on this crawler at a whopping 1 mile an hour. And the thing that always gets me is seeing the scale of people next to this thing. You got people on the crawler waving at us as we go by, and they just look like tiny little, you know, like dioramas where you get those little people in there. You know, it's just amazing. It's kind of weird because from the distance, even though we're close to it, it still looks smaller than it is. But then when you put the people in there, you realize, oh my goodness, this is a huge rocket. And you know, you're feeling the shaking of the ground as this thing is slowly creeping around these rocks from the Mississippi they use to kind of keep it, you know, from catching. And it's just an amazing experience.
We're going to post your images. They're on our website, cfpublic.org. When you were out there on Saturday, you know, it was rolling out. The astronauts were there watching it roll out. There was also press there. Can you just give a sense of how many people were out there watching this thing? How big of a moment was this?
The email we got from NASA saying that there was at least 150 people from the media, but there were also employees, their families. They were getting brought in through these, you know, VIP coach buses. And there were, of course, people that probably came in from a VIP situation. I would say at least 1,000 or more people. It was a spectacle. And, you know, everybody's in their blankets because it was a cold morning. One of the few Florida mornings where it's in the 30s Fahrenheit. It was just cool seeing everybody. You know, we're taking the photos, and the people, there's another rope that has the people that are just watching behind us, almost kind of like an air show kind of style, where everybody's in their lawn chairs and, you know, their folding chairs and sitting there and all that. And they're all cheering on. And it's just a cool energy, cool vibe, if you will, you know, just a feeling that like everybody's just, wow, we're going back to the moon. I mean, that's just an energy that you can't replicate. And it's hard to capture that in just a single photo, right? But it's just amazing.
I had the pleasure of watching you work during Artemis 1. What is your plan moving forward for Artemis 2? How are you going to capture this launch? And then what do you plan to do with some of these images?
You know, not only am I doing the photography for Central Florida Public Media and all that, the other capacity that I have is I run a planetarium. And one thing that's really great about a planetarium is that it's a virtual reality simulation. And what I got a chance to do while I was taking these photos is I also brought my 360 camera and was able to create a virtual reality footage of the rollout. And I uploaded it to the planetarium dome and I showed it to a couple of people and they're like, wow, this feels like I'm right there. You're hearing the roar, you're hearing the cheers, you're hearing all that stuff that you're missing with the photos. Not only am I capturing these unbelievable photos of the launch and things like that, we're able to also create these virtual reality experiences for guests that come out to the planetarium to feel what I felt. And so when you're asking those kind of questions, I can say, yes, I can show you. You can see me in the background, you know, talking and narrating what's going on and hearing the cheers and hearing the people and feeling that and feeling the rocket move. And so I'm hoping to recreate that for the launch. I'm hoping to set up a remote camera to capture that launch and also be able to do some of that 360 video as well to be able to share that experience with others. And the long-term goal, one of the things that I'm hoping to achieve is doing some type of live stream in the planetarium or doing a live stream where we're actually being able to share that experience in real time. It's a little bit harder now with the technology, but you know, the idea would be to make this accessible to everybody. So that's something that I'm really excited about doing for the future.
We've been speaking with Derek Demeter. He is the director of the Emil Bueller Planetarium at Seminole State College. He's also chronicling the Artemis 2 campaign for Central Florida Public Media. Derek, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
And while we are now one step closer to seeing NASA astronauts fly around the moon once again, it has taken a while for the agency to get to this point. From pressure nationally for the U.S. to beat China to the moon, to the people working on making the mission possible, there is a lot that has happened to get us to this point. Here to talk more about the mission, its delays, pressure, and how NASA is preparing for launch is Don Platt, the director of the Spaceport Education Center at Florida Tech. Don, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Thank you.
Hey, so a pretty big milestone for the Artemis 2 mission campaign. The vehicle is now at the launch pad. Don, just reflect on how big of a moment this is for not only Artemis 2, but for the Artemis program as a whole.
Yeah, there's certainly been a lot of delays, a lot of fits and starts, questions about whether the program was going to continue, if it was worth it, why are we going back to the moon? Whenever you get hardware out and ready for a real launch and including people on board that launch, then things sort of shift gears and it becomes all about the mission and what they're accomplishing here, hopefully in the next month or so, getting humans back to the moon finally.
What goes into the moments or the days that come now that the rocket is at the pad before the human launch? What does launch leaders have to do to get it ready for those people?
Well, usually what happens is when they're putting together the vehicle, what they call stacking the vehicle in the vehicle assembly building, they come across a few problems here and there. They do a few tests and maybe things aren't exactly perfect or they find something that they want to look at a little more. So what they're really doing right now is kind of going back through all the data that they've collected, making sure that all those tests are okay or they can justify why they can fly the vehicle if there's one little thing here or there that isn't exactly what they expected it to be when they tested it, in the VAB, for instance. And of course, when they're on the launch pad, they are doing additional tests and checks and configurations. And of course, then they have to worry about making sure all the connections on the launch pad are working properly and everything's ready to go. You don't want to get to the situation where you're in the final countdown and there's a connection that isn't working right or there's a leak or something just isn't going right. So they're going to do as much as they possibly can now to go through all that data, go through all the connections for the launch pad, make sure they're ready to go for when they do get to the point of that final countdown.
Don, you and I have talked quite a bit in the past over your experience building another mega space architecture, the International Space Station, and working on that hardware on the ground and then seeing it launch and then seeing it built up in space. It's got to be a thrilling experience. What do you think the engineers and the technicians are thinking now of the thousands and thousands of hours that they spent working on SLS and Orion, and now it's just really in the grand scheme of things, moments away from going into space. What could possibly be going through their heads?
There's certainly a lot of young engineers who haven't had a lot of experience seeing their hardware fly in space. And certainly there's almost nobody around the Space Center and really around the country that's worked the Artemis program that was around when the Apollo astronauts went to the moon. So most of these people, even if they are old veterans, have never really experienced the idea that when you look up at the moon at night, there's astronauts nearby to that moon. So I'm sure that in many ways, it may not even really hit them until they see it happen. They're so engaged and so focused right now on making sure everything's ready to go for the mission. They've put in so many long hours and weekends and sleepless nights, worried about every little detail. And so probably won't really hit them. And even when they see it, they'll be processing it, but it might take some time even after it happens and the mission is over before it really sinks in and hits them.
Artemis 1 was a success for the most part. Took a while to get it off the ground, but that's pretty normal for a new vehicle. Came back in one piece and relatively successful mission. What makes this one different now that humans are on board, Don?
Really, when there's astronauts on board, then you have to sort of have another level of vigilance. There has to be a concern to make sure that any level of redundancy is ready to go. In case there is a failure, the backup system will work properly. Everybody has to be in place in case there are some problems. You know, we can look back at the very famous Apollo 13 movie and think about all of the engineers on the ground that were running through ideas and testing possibilities to make sure the crew got back safely. And so all of those kinds of engineering support programs will be put in place to enable the astronauts to have both a safe and successful mission.
Looking back to your experience on Space Station, Dawn, how much input did those astronauts have in kind of the design, development, the building, and the deployment of the International Space Station? And do you think that the same is happening for the Free Artemis program?
Sure. Yeah. In fact, there were what we call blue suitors all around our hardware at Kennedy Space Center. And blue suitor is an astronaut because they typically wear their blue flight suits wherever they go. And so they were highly involved. They were involved not only from the point of view of the early decisions to, design choices, engineering choices for the station itself, but as the vehicle was coming together, they were involved. They were in the vehicle to make sure they understood every part of it so that when they flew on that space station, when it was in space, it was like the back of their hand. They knew it all already and could easily troubleshoot a problem or know where every component was so that it's almost like living at home and you know instantly, even at night when you go to the bathroom, you know right where that light switch is. And the astronauts will know everything about the vehicle because they've been completely and totally immersed in this for years now, actually.
Very important design choice there, right? Where's the bathroom light switch?
Right.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Don Platt, the director of the Spaceport Education Center at Florida Tech. Don, at the start of our conversation, we talked about the Artemis 2 mission, our pathway to get here. It fits and starts. All sorts of things happened. What has been the fuel or the momentum to move Artemis forward the way that it has? What's been the motivation for NASA?
Well, of course, one motivation is to see this program through and to get astronauts back to the moon. But another aspect of that, too, is the fact that the Chinese are rapidly developing a lunar exploration program. Now, they haven't really initially kind of announced plans to specifically say, yeah, in a year we're going to have Chinese astronauts on the moon or anything, but they are incrementally really achieving some amazing things in space. In fact, they have their own space station now that they operate on a regular basis with crews going up to it and coming back again. They have a series of robotic probes that have actually worked on the moon, have driven around the moon, and even on the far side of the moon, which is a bit more challenging because you don't have direct communication back to the Earth from that far side. And so, and that's something that we really never did. We never really had rovers on the far side of the moon. So there's a lot of evidence that the Chinese are going to want to move forward with a very robust lunar program here in the next 10 years, certainly, and probably in the next 5 years. And so there's definitely a need from the point of view of the United States to make sure that the U.S. also has a presence then at the moon and specifically with humans and developing potentially in the future then at least short-term bases where people can live and work on the moon for at least maybe up to a 90-day period at a time, moving forward to eventually having a system where they could live there sort of permanently with rotation, sort of like Antarctica.
Are there parallels to the Apollo program? You know, that was the space race with the Soviets. Is this similar in that respect?
Yeah, I think so. I think that we do have a new space race with the Chinese. The Chinese are definitely improving their technology for space. And so we don't want to be left behind. I know that the U.S. military is certainly monitoring what's happening with the Chinese in space. And there's a lot of concern about what types of vehicles and what types of activity will be occurring around the moon in what they call cislunar space over the next, 5 to 10 years. Certainly having American astronauts there sort of, makes everyone aware that the U.S. is still highly involved and dedicated to lunar exploration.
And it seems that this presidential administration is all in with this program, right? We've seen budget requests coming from the White House that support human exploration, including Artemis 2 and beyond. What do we know about the presidential administration's hand in this? Are they truly all in on the Artemis missions?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, in fact, this Artemis 2 mission was sort of moved to what we call the left. And so when they move something to the left, that means kind of makes it happen quicker. Usually in space, we're used to schedules going out to the right or being delayed. And so I believe certainly the Trump administration sees that it's critically important the United States maintains leadership in space, especially with human involvement in space. And, you know, these kinds of very large and grand projects certainly kind of, I think, fit with visions that Donald Trump has of what the United States is supposed to be about. And so I think that this presidential administration is definitely extremely focused on getting Artemis to be a success and really wants to see then not only humans going around the moon who are Americans, but then also having them land on the moon, you know, start those activities again that we haven't done since 1972.
Those activities are a critical part of that grand vision for the Artemis program and the Trump administration, right? But there are some concerns with timeline on that, right? I mean, bring us up to speed on where we're at when it comes to Artemis 3, which would be when the astronauts put their feet on the surface of the moon. Are we close to that?
One of the major pieces of hardware that is needed for landing humans on the moon is an operational Starship. And so, of course, the Starship is being developed by SpaceX. And they've had a few issues here and there as they've moved forward with this huge new vehicle. And developing, proving, and testing this technology has been perhaps a bigger challenge than maybe they even anticipated that it would be. The first and most important thing really for the Artemis 3 mission is to get an operational Starship. And just one that is in low Earth orbit like they want to test here in the next couple of months is not enough, of course. It has to be then a vehicle that can support humans landing on the moon. And so last fall, we did see some high profile stirrings, I suppose we could say, within NASA and within the Trump administration that if SpaceX doesn't sort of get things in gear there with that lunar lander, then they had an interest in looking at potential competitors. And of course, Blue Origin is also building a lunar lander. And I'm sure they figured it wouldn't hurt their goals to put together a bit of a competition between Blue Origin and SpaceX, at least from a political pressure point of view, to get those two to quickly complete the development of a lunar lander, which will certainly be needed to get humans on the surface of the moon, certainly by what we've heard of 2028.
We've been speaking with Don Platt. He's the director of the Spaceport Education Center at Florida Tech. Don, always great to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Still to come, how microscopic organisms are teaching us about human spaceflight.
They can live almost anywhere on Earth and survive incredibly harsh conditions. They've survived almost absolute zero temperatures and over 300 degrees Fahrenheit.
We'll look at tardigrades or water bears. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. There have been bears in space, but not those big mammals. We're talking about water bears. Scientists have been studying these water bears, or tardigrades as they're called, uncovering the secret to survival in extreme conditions. These creatures are microscopic animals, and they can withstand some extreme conditions, even space. So what can we learn from these organisms when it comes to human spaceflight? We'll hear talk more about these not-so-furry animals is Are We There Yet's intern Orion Boone.
Tardigrades, water bears, moss piglets. These are all names for a phylum full of Earth's hardiest creatures. They can survive the hottest hots, the coldest colds, and radiation of all sorts, all while being about as big as a grain of salt. But the big question, can they survive space? Are We There Yet's Orion Boone has been on the search for that answer and how we as humans might benefit from these little buggers. Orion, welcome to the show.
Hi, Brennan. Happy to be here.
So let's cut right to the chase. Can tardigrades survive space?
They can, actually, but there is so much more to them.
All right, so tell me a little bit about these little guys.
So tardigrades were discovered in 1773 by a German zoologist who named them little water bears because of their pudgy bear-like appearance. If you've ever seen a picture, they're so adorable to me. They can live almost anywhere on Earth and survive incredibly harsh conditions. They've survived almost absolute zero temperatures and over 300 degrees Fahrenheit. They've been shot out of a gun at 1,800 miles per hour with six times the pressure of the bottom of the ocean. They've been stored in a freezer for 30 years and survived that. They survived tons of UV and ionizing radiations, high levels of carbon monoxide and dioxide, and the vacuum of space. They use water to breathe through their skins like frogs, and they eat algae, bacteria, and other small invertebrates. The thing is, though, they can go a long, long time without any food or water.
So they are hardy little buggers. How long can they go without food or water?
Almost a decade.
Whoa.
They use a process called cryptobiosis. It's a process of slowing down their metabolism almost entirely when conditions aren't quite right. It's like an extreme form of hibernation. They have a lot of different ways they do that, but the coolest to me is their tun state. It's the longest version of the cryptobiosis. When the water becomes unsuitable, whether it's too cold or salty or there's just no water at all, they shrivel up until the water becomes more tolerable. Their metabolism gets slowed to 0.01% of normal. They also produce these proteins that don't have a stable shape or job. When tardigrades get extremely dehydrated during this tun state, these proteins help protect their cells' outer layer.
Meanwhile, I'm hungry 2 hours after I eat lunch, and these little buggers are going decades. So, okay, so you talked about cryptobiosis. They can live almost anywhere on Earth, right? So I've got to assume they may be able to use these powers to live in space, right?
They sure can, Brendan. So during the European Space Agency's Photon 3 missions, tardigrades were sent into low Earth orbit and survived quite well in the vacuum of space, but had pretty low rates of survival when exposed to solar radiation. I feel like I would have a low rate of survival, too.
Me too, yeah.
There's also been several long-term missions aboard the ISS. These studies are looking at how tardigrades protect themselves and what they can teach us about human spaceflight.
Well, what can they teach us? What have we learned from these experiments?
So we've been trying to find out what makes them so resilient, and I think we found it. Originally, tardigrades' secret weapon was thought to be the sugar called tetrahelose. What the tardigrade would do is replace the water in its body with sugar. We later found that they don't produce enough to be protected by these extreme conditions. But in 2016, this researcher Takuma Hashimoto and his team discovered a protein made by tardigrades called DSUP, short for damage suppressor protein. Since then, scientists have seen it protect from oxidative stress, like the carbon monoxide and dioxide I mentioned earlier, UV radiation, ionizing radiation, and they also activate a specific process to help the cell repair itself. I talked to Silvia Cantara and Giampiero Cai, two professors from the University of Siena in Italy. Here's Silvia on repairing cells.
We have seen that under oxidative stress, it protects DNA, but also activates all the scavenger programs that the cells have to detoxify the environment. Under UV radiation, the mechanism is different because in this case, we have more DNA breaks, but the cells rapidly correct these breaks because these apps activate, increase the expression of some mechanisms that are in the cells to repair DNA breaks.
Basically, when these tardigrade cells are damaged, DSUP swoops in to both protect the cells and start the repair process to nurse it back to health.
Oh, that's pretty fascinating.
You're listening to Are We There Yet, the radio show exploring space exploration. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Are We There Yet's intern, Orion Boone, about what scientists are learning from tardigrades.
So that begs the question, can we use DSUP? I mean, tardigrades are super hardy. We think that's the reason why. We see that here on Earth. Could we take Deese up to space?
We very well could. Researchers are trying to figure that out, but it certainly looks like it could head that way. Plants, even here on Earth, have to deal with harsh sunlight, drought, temperature swings. In space, they have much harsher conditions our plants aren't used to. High levels of cosmic radiation, limited water, low gravity. Deese up could be a biological shield to plant DNA from those stresses. Giampiero, along with a few others, studied how Deese up affects pollen and tobacco plants, a plant used relatively frequently in research. Pollen is very sensitive to different stressors like UV, but it's also needed for plant reproduction, obviously. We need pollen to survive if we ever want to propagate plants in outer space. Here's Giampiero on what he found.
Given these results, we published a paper about 1 year ago, I think, about the first indications that transformed pollen can tolerate much better UVB. And so they can survive, they can grow, they can have a number of positive effects.
Pollen is very, very delicate, so Deese up working to protect it could one day help us create crops that thrive in space or even, you know, helps plants here on Earth adapt to climate change.
All right, so we can make super plants, but we want humans on the moon and Mars and even beyond continuing to explore space. Let's go superhero here. Could you and I have Deese up running around in our cells?
Short answer, we could. Deese up is a massive protein compared to ours. It's about 4,500 amino acids long. But that hasn't stopped us from experimenting with the idea. We haven't jumped straight to humans yet. Scientists started with fruit flies and small human cell cultures. The results showed some protection from radiation and oxidative stress, but there were also some trade-offs. Here's Silvio on what she saw.
Their life was longer. Transfective flies had a longer life compared to untransfective one, but for example, they moved slowly. So it seems that the protein somehow is a stress for the cells, for the organism. And in flies, the only thing that they observed was these slower movements.
Time will only tell how it impacts other animals, really.
So this protein was discovered from these little buggers, the tardigrades, and now we're going bigger and bigger and larger and farther into space. What's next for Deese up? We're going to get Deese up superhumans, Orion?
There's still a lot to learn before we get to that point. Deese up was discovered a decade ago. We still don't fully know how to apply it or where its boundaries lie. A project I have my eye on is Minerva. Scientists plan on modifying a small nematode's genome with Deese up and sending it into a cislunar orbit, basically between the moon and the Earth, for about 4 months. The combination of the long time frame and this complex of an organism really makes me excited. Here's Sylvia on what she thinks Deese up research might look like further down the road.
We cannot think to protect astronauts' own cells from within. If we address safety and delivery questions, why not? We can think, for example, in drugs. Why not? Drugs that can protect astronauts from radiation from the within, but without having any effect on the humans, of course, on the astronauts itself. So many, many questions that need to be addressed.
And as Giampiero puts it, this really is just the beginning.
And what about the next? Difficult to say, because I think that this sub can have, a number of advantages if it works, and I think it works. So I'm very excited to see what implants can do.
I'm just super excited to see where this research goes.
And we're super excited to chat with you about it. Orion Boone is Are We There Yet? Intern Orion, thank you so much for bringing us up to speed on what these little buggers are teaching us about the proteins flowing through our bodies.
Thank you for having me, Brendan.
No problem. That was Are We There Yet's intern, Orion Boone. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at @AWTYSpace. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you think you might make a good guest, well, reach out to us. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.